Coming up on This Week in Broadway, we talk with Isaac Hurwitz of the New York Musical Theater Festival. We also talk about the Goodspeed Opera House production of Carousel, plus a lot of other things in the news. So stay tuned and listen. Welcome to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway for Sunday, August 5th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Peter Felicia. Michael is away on vacation.
He's not on vacation. He's organizing a parade because End of the Rainbow is closing. That's what he's doing. He's thrilled that it's not going to be with us anymore, and Tracy Bennett's brilliant performance will not be able to be seen ever again. I am saying right away that you don't have much time to see End of the Rainbow, and I really hope that you go. You may very well agree with Michael in thinking this is an atrocity and a disgrace, or you might very well agree with me that it is one of the most incandescent performances you've ever seen or will see. But I do think you owe it to yourself to go to the Belasco and see this performance, which has been so controversial. So,
You only have 2 weeks left from today, Sunday the 5th. It closes
August 19th. I think they're closing the 12th. I could be wrong. But anyway, whatever. Times are tough. You have to get there fast.
Got to get there fast.
And I would say if you live in, let's say, Calcutta, yeah, take the trip. You know, it's worth it. And again, you may be furious with me afterwards. But
Peter, I do think that End of the Rainbow is going out on a national tour, isn't it?
Yes, I hope so. I really do. Let's hear it for the Rainbow Tour. I hope it really happens. It would be very nice if that were to occur. So I want other people to see this.
I wonder what they'll name the tour. You know, it's kind of inside baseball, but yeah, tours get names like the Phantom Tours get the Music Box and the Raoul Company and various different things that are named. So I wonder if they'll call that the Rainbow Tour.
That'd Judy Beloy was in Les Mis on the road, and Le Troisième Compagnie, which meant the third company.
Yes.
You know? But it sounded so much more elegant in French. Not my French, of course, but I mean in real French. It was very funny to hear her always refer to that. It does sound better than bus and truck.
This is true, and you know, later this afternoon we're going to go shopping at Target.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah.
you know, I didn't properly give you an introduction. Peter Felicia is the person you hear on the other end speaking when I'm not speaking, and Peter is a writer, and you could see his, you could read his writing. Well, you could see it as well. At Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, the Critchland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Let me be formal and say good morning, Peter.
Hi.
So, yes, End of the Rainbow is closing, and Michael is organizing a parade. He's up in Provincetown on a much-deserved vacation this week, and hopefully he will be back next week. I give a warning to everybody right now that we will not be recording next week on Sunday. We are recording next week on Monday evening so that we can speak to Bruce Kimmel. He's going to join us from California. We couldn't... You know, if we recorded on Sunday morning, he'd have to get up at 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, and that wasn't going to happen. So we moved to Monday night. So look for us next week on Tuesday morning instead. This week, I got out to, got in my car and drove up to East Haddam, Connecticut, to the Goodspeed Opera House, where I saw Carousel.
Any good?
I'm a big fan of the show, and I have very high standards for this show. And they have met and exceeded these standards.
How nice.
It was really a wonderful production of Carousel. And and done, you know, I said to myself, how are they going to do it on this tiny Goodspeed stage? It's such a large ensemble. And what they did was they just cut the ensemble back.
You know, when they did 1776 a few years ago, I was worried about that too. I mean, that's a lot of beef on that stage. And yet, it accommodated everybody beautifully. I was very surprised. You know, you didn't have simply like one delegate from Delaware. You still had three. And it was pretty impressive to me. It is a deceptive space, but they did cut back on the ensemble, huh?
It seems like they did. The cast is relatively large in the 20s.
Sure.
But, you know, I don't know how you can't possibly do Carousel with less than that.
There was a production once of Carousel that was in Washington that was hoping to come in. This was in the 80s, I believe. And where it scrimped, it didn't have a carousel. It had people pretending to be the horses on the carousel, and that had to make do. Did they have a carousel here?
They did not have a carousel. They did something very similar. What they did was they put up a cyclorama,
uh-huh,
a scrim,
yeah,
and they projected the shadows of carousel horses going by, and they did the acts in front of it, and they had one horse that they used in the prologue that they put center stage, and Billy Bigelow picked up Julie Jordan, put her on the horse, and flirted with her, and got Mrs. Mullins all upset. So they had one horse.
Vivian Vance, Ethel from I Love Lucy,
yeah,
was originally cast as Mrs. Mullins back in 1945.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. it's amazing. But
Or the film?
The original Broadway production. Okay. I mean, when they're first doing it, 1945. So what had happened was that she had done a show earlier with Agnes DeMille called Hold On to Your Hats, and Agnes was canned, and she always held Vivian responsible because, as the story goes, I'm not saying this is true, I wasn't there, but Vivian was cavorting with a number of the people who were writing slash directing slash doing the show. I'm not going to say with whom, and I have no idea if this is really true, but the story has gone around that Vivian was sleeping around. And it's so funny to think of Ethel Mertz doing that, but nevertheless, you know, this was, you know, sometime earlier. But anyway, so Reuben Malmulian cast Vivian Vance as Mrs. Mullen, and Agnes DeMille said, "Over my dead body," and given that it wasn't an important role, she was cut before the show even went into rehearsals, I believe. So it's funny to think of Mrs. Mullen. Anyway, go on.
So let me correct myself. The cast is actually, according to the playbill, 32 members.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's impressive.
I counted at the curtain call, and I thought it was in the high 20s, but obviously I missed something. But it certainly, they really used every square inch of that stage.
Sure.
And Teal Wicks, who's playing Julie Jordan, I think up until today or so, she's actually leaving the production, you know, to go do Jekyll and Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
But she was wonderful.
That's right. Jekyll and Hyde does start rehearsals tomorrow, right?
Yeah. James Snyder.
Jeff Calvin did mention that to me.
James Snyder is Billy Bigelow, who my wife kept on saying looks like a young Hugh Jackman.
Uh-huh, that's a pretty good thing, yeah.
And he's got a great voice. I said, young Hugh Jackman, how old is Hugh Jackman? You know, but James Snyder is certainly easy on the eyes, according to my wife. And
well, the real bottom line is it doesn't take long to age, as we were talking last week about Danielle Ferland, Little Red Riding Hood, suddenly playing the Thelma Ritter role in New Girl in Town. So, you know, and we all lose our charms in the end, and it doesn't happen so slowly as we'd like it to. So,
one of the reasons I went so far to see Carousel is because, you know, I can certainly see local productions of Carousel.
Sure.
But, you know, Goodspeed and the larger regional organizations really pull the stops out when casting, and they cast this thing so solidly all the way through. I mean, the woman who plays Louise, Billy's daughter, such not only a great dancer, but a great actress. Jeff Creedy played Enoch Snow, and he stole the show.
Ah, how nice.
The guy who played Jigger is named Tally Sessions, and he they had just really outrageous talent from start to finish out there, and they've already extended it, extended the performances into September. So if you do have a chance, I highly recommend getting up to Goodspeed to see Carousel, because
when I was in high school, during one very boring biology class, I made a list of the 50 greatest songs that I had ever heard from Broadway musicals. Now, the thing is, for one thing, this was so long ago, there were far fewer Broadway musicals. The other thing is, I hadn't heard every original cast album that had ever been made at that point in high school. But my point is that in the number one position, I put the soliloquy from Carousel. And here it is all these many, many decades later. And if I had to make that list again, the number one selection would be the soliloquy from Carousel. In a way, that's a little sad to think that since 1945, nothing has surpassed that in my estimation, of course. But nevertheless, it is, to me, the greatest achievement the musical theater has ever made.
James Snyder knocks it out of the park.
He
does it very, very well. I can't say enough good things. I really enjoyed it. In fact, my wife has said that she wants to go back and see the new Julie Jordan. So it's
how interesting. Wow, that is a great compliment when somebody's willing to do that. So that says more than anything
that's
else.
That's a 3-hour drive both directions for us. So it's it was really a wonderful thing. And East Haddam, just like our little Bucks County Playhouse, they both have great little towns right there.
Oh, yeah. It is amazing, though, that a place that is so hard to get to if you don't have a car has done so well. Now, granted, I mean, the suburban Connecticut audience has cars. But, I mean, for the rest of us who live in New York, I mean, not much time has passed on all that chat before somebody says, is there any way to get to Goodspeed without a car? You know, I mean,
absolutely.
You know, so it's something that everybody wants to do. They want to get out there. But
I wonder if I could, if there would be interest enough to put together a few buses to go from New York to go to Goodspeed and come home that night.
Yeah, it's amazing. Somebody must have tried it, or it must have got to the stage where somebody says, no, it's not cost effective to do it.
Yeah.
But it really is a shame that it's not more accessible. But looking at the glasses half full, what an amazing thing that Michael Price has done out there.
Absolutely.
I mean, who would have thought in the mid-60s when this was starting up that this could possibly succeed? Yeah, and Michael was smart to find out what they like and how they liked it, and gave it to them just that way. There were certainly musicals from way back when, from the 20s, the 30s, maybe even earlier than the 20s, that he scheduled. I mean, it's where I saw Dearest Enemy, a Rodgers and Hart show. It's where I saw Louisiana Purchase. All right, that's a 40s show, but still, you get the point. If you want to see these things, this is where you went, you know, and because nobody else was doing them. And, of course, time has passed, and now, of course, they're doing shows that are, well, here we are, you know, I mean, Carousel is 67 years old, you know, and so now they're drawing from a more recent vintage, so to speak, it's wonderful that that place has done so well, and I believe, if I'm not wrong, that they've received not only one, but I think two Tony Awards.
Two Tony Awards
for regional theater.
And Tony Awards are right in the lobby.
You know what they were going to do once? I remember I saw the plans for it. I saw the blueprints. And I don't know why this fell through, but they were going to build a statue of Don Quixote in front of the theater because Man of La Mancha started there.
Oh,
and what's really funny, of course, about Man of La Mancha, people have said over the years when they listened to the original cast of Man of La Mancha, the cast album, how did this Jewish guy, Irving Jacobson, wind up playing Sancho Panza? Well, actually, it was a season where they were doing three shows in a rap. Actually, I think it turned out to be two. One show never happened. But the thing was that he was hired really for a different role in a different show, and they, well, have him play Sancho. What the hell? Nobody expected La Mancha was going to turn out to be what La Mancha turned out to be. But they were going to build a statue in its honor, you know, and I don't know what happened. I guess I do know what happened. They didn't raise the money. Nobody thought it was a good enough idea to put money behind it. But believe me, once upon a time that was going to happen right in front of the theater.
You know, it's it. My wife says to me, "You know, you take me to all these theaters to the first being Paper Mill and the Bucks County Playhouse, and now Goodspeed." She says, "Do you have to be? Do you have to find a theater that's on the banks of a river? All of them have these picturesque, just stunning, stunning views from the theater." So, yes, as again, get up to Goodspeed and see Carousel, and you know. Goodspeed never seems to disappoint.
If I loved you, words would come in an easy way. Round in circles I go.
With us this morning, we have Isaac Hurwitz. Isaac is the executive director and producer of the New York Musical Theater Festival. And we were talking about the festival last week, and Isaac is joining us to kind of give us his point of view on what was said. So good morning, Isaac. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So there were a few things that were said last week on the podcast, and unfortunately, as we mentioned before, Michael is up in Provincetown on vacation and couldn't get to us by Skype or of a landline. But we feel bad that the timing of this is not working out so well, but we felt it need to bring you on as soon as possible to talk about your point of view on the festival. So why don't you let us know what your thoughts are?
Well, you know, my feeling about the festival is that you know, when I started the festival with Chris Stewart 9 years ago, we really had no idea that there would be quite so many shows that would have life after the festival. The goal of the festival from the start was really to help artists get their works up on their feet and to see them in three dimensions with a professional support and collaborators of a caliber and with attention, marketing attention and press attention that they couldn't really achieve on their own. That was really the vision of the festival because certainly at that time, I think, we felt there were limited options for public staging of new works that weren't, you know, full productions that were going to cost, you know, $500,000 for a new musical. And so, you know, the dream was that one or two every season would have some sort of life after the festival, and that for the rest of them, it would be a learning experience for the artists. It would lead to new collaborations. It would lead to discovery and other jobs. And for some shows, it would be about, you know, just about the recognition, finding whatever small audience that was, and then moving on to the next project. So I think that in the first year of the festival, and maybe even the second year of the festival, we were all astonished by how many shows had been sitting in drawers, having had reading after reading after reading. And so there were quite a number of shows out of that first season that transferred directly off Broadway because they had been polished to a fine sheen reading after reading after reading. That's just not the case anymore. I think the landscape has changed. We've gone through 350 shows, and there are now other opportunities for things. And I think that what we're seeing at the festival is not a deterioration of the festival, but it's a shift in that we're seeing lots of fresh or raw or new material by and large, stuff that has been written expressly for the festival. And, you know, without questioning the reviews of individual shows, I think, you know, a piece like Forever Man, which did not, you know, was not positively reviewed on this broadcast, is a brand new original show, as I think you mentioned, you know, and underwent an enormous amount of revision between when it was submitted to the festival and when it went up on its feet. So I think NIMF is serving a different function for writers in some regard than it did in 2004, and I don't think that's a bad thing. So that's sort of the as a basis, I just like to say why I think Nymph is here and the role that it serves. And it's still a $25 ticket, and it's still, I think, incredibly powerful at getting new artists noticed, and the success rate of artists getting other jobs out of the festival, and even the success rate of shows transferring to further development options and then production.
Isaac, I'm not sure that anybody really didn't give proper respect to where Nymph has come from and where what has done over the 350 shows that you produced over the number of years. I think the thing was more about the shows that the increased cost to participate in Nymph and what has happened in the last couple of years. And again, this was anecdotal evidence. I've not produced a Nymph, so I don't really know what the costs are. So why don't you run down the costs of producing a show in Nymph?
Sure. Well, Nymph covers the shared costs of a show. So the theater venue, the staffing of that venue, the lighting and the sound repertory plots, which if you've seen a Nymph show, you know that those are pretty extensive. They're, more than you might have for a traditional off-Broadway show because they have to be flexible enough to accommodate five or six shows in a venue. What the individual shows cover are their independent expenses like rehearsal space, actors, and costume costs, things like that. And the Nymph charges certain fees to the shows, which have been pretty much constant over the years. They've taken different forms because we have, as Michael mentioned, had criticism in earlier years. We had some criticism that, particularly writer-producers who were coming in not with a lot of experience as producers, not knowing how much things cost and how to contain those costs, didn't know what they were getting into. So we've structured those costs very concretely as best as we can. We charge a fee for the venue repertory plots, which is a per-performance fee of between $450 and $600, depending on whether you're in a 99-seat venue or a 200-seat venue, so you have more opportunity to recoup in a larger venue, so we charge you a little bit more and we spend a bit more. Then we charge a per-actor, per-performance fee for the wireless microphones, if you choose to use wireless microphones. And that covers not just the mics, but the belt packs and the condoms that are used to protect the microphones. And the cost of having somebody who is maintaining all of those microphones across the festival. And that's probably cheaper than anyone would ever be able to get those independently. And then we charge a sound engineer fee of $100 per performance, which is to cover the cost of somebody to mix the show. And we decided that it was important that be centrally done because in earlier years, there were situations where one person's sound mixer screwed up the sound patching in the board for the next show in the venue. And then, of course, not only is Nymph to blame, but it's just not fair to the show. Nymph gets blamed, but it's there's nothing anyone can do about it for the next show, which turns around in an hour and a half. So some of the centralization of costs has happened because we've tried to increase the quality of the technical service that we're providing. The thing that I think has really increased in cost overall has been personnel. In the first year of the festival, Nymph was on a showcase code, and which meant that actors were paid reimbursement for their travel expenses, and Nymph could only be in 99-seat venues, which was very limiting for the spaces that we could use. But it was very affordable for the producers, and over the years, Actors Equity had increased the minimum stipend that was paid to actors, and other unions followed suit, including SDC, the Directors and Choreographers Union, and the Musicians Union, which insists that musicians be paid whatever the actors are making on this. Now, these are not negotiated agreements. These are not agreements that I go out and I say, this is what I think we should be paying. But because everyone is making less than minimum wage, they're basically donating their time still at NIMF. It's not a negotiated agreement. It's what the unions, they determine it. And we could either walk away and not do the festival, or we could allow it to happen. So those costs now, actors and musicians make $850 for the run of the show, which I think is still objectively a bargain from the perspective of, you know, compared to what you would do if you were producing a workshop of a show. But it is a very much larger burden to bear if you're a writer putting up your own show and you have a 20-person musical.
And Isaac, I want to let me understand if I understand this correctly from you, is that these fees, that these costs that you're talking about, are not paid to the festival. They're paid to Actors Equity or into a bond that pays the actors. That the festival's not getting anything out of these fees.
The festival doesn't get anything out of those fees.
So let's rather than have a symposium here on producing, let's talk about the fees that are paid directly to NIMF. Is there a fee to submit your show? Is there a fee to get it up? And because I think that fairly, those are the only things that we could hold you accountable for. We can't hold you accountable for SDC and for IA and for, you know, Actors Equity and various other things like that.
Sure. No, but James, the reason I raise that is that has been the massive increase in what individual producers are covering.
Yeah.
And so while, you know, obviously NIMF isn't responsible for that and can't control that, the experience that it is more and more expensive to produce at NIMF comes primarily from that.
Okay.
And so what NIMF gets is pretty constant, and, you know, those fees that I described, they're less than $5,000 in total. Now, for our invited shows, there is a participation fee, which ranges from $1,500 to $6,000, depending on all sorts of things. It's a negotiated fee, but those participation fees are waived for our Next Link shows. That's part of the purpose of our Next Link process, is to make sure that it's accessible to writers who are self-producing.
Can you tell me what Next Link is?
The Next Link is our open submission program, which 10 shows a year are chosen from. Forever Man was one of those shows. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice the year before was another one. These are ones that the writers generally submit the shows, and they it goes through a blind submission process, so our readers don't know, and our grand jury looks at all these scripts, and we choose 10 shows. Which will receive subsidized productions in the festival, as well as dramaturgical support and a lot of networking help to help them build their team and to fundraise for the festival.
All right.
So there's the services that we provide are, you know, it's not as though these shows are then cast out on their own and we say, okay, now you've got to raise between $20,000 and $60,000, which is what I think, generally speaking, depending on the scale of the show, individual NIMF shows are costing these days.
In fact, my friend Beowulf Borat, the set designer, says, you know, if somebody has $50, I can give them a set for $50. I can do that. I prefer to work with more. What is, if somebody came to you and said, look, I don't have much money, what is really the bare minimum that it's going to cost me to be in this festival?
I tell full productions that unless you're a one-man show, mm-hmm. it's really next to impossible to do this for less than $15,000 to $20,000. If you count just the people involved, you can't do a show with, you know, you have to pay them between $850 and $1,000 a piece. So that's a lot of dollars. What NIMF gets is at minimum, NIMF is making, you know, about $3,000 to somewhere, you know, for the biggest shows, all fees included, about $8,000 or $9,000.
So on the revenue side, on ticket sales, what's the split there?
It's basically a 50-50 split.
So that's how the shows recoup is if, you know, if they're if they have a $30,000 budget, they need to sell $60,000 in tickets to break even. You know, napkin math.
There is no expectation of breaking even. And we are very upfront about that. You know, if you're in a 200-seat theater, which is our largest theater, and your tickets are $25, and there are comps for press, and there are discounted tickets that are going to be made available because you're not selling all of your matinees, you know, we tell people that, you know, our successful shows will make back, you know, $10,000 to $12,000.
Great. Okay. So that's really good information to know about that.
We're very clear with shows, particularly if you have a large show. You can't view this as a break-even proposition. It's a loss leader. It's a development cost, and that's why over the years, you know, there obviously have been the criticisms that Michael raised. Those have been very much criticisms that have been raised in past years of the festival, but where I sort of took umbrage is that we go so out of our way to improve the festival every year. What I was hearing between the discussion of the Dramatists Guild and the discussion of our fee structure was outdated by at least 3 years. And so I felt that, you know, we now, before anyone comes into the festival, we have a phone conversation with them where we walk them through a sample budget, we talk them through the fees. And we make sure that they're, you know, the hardest part of this is making sure that everybody's expectations are on the same plate, because everyone comes to Nymph with different goals. Some people just want to see their show up on its feet. Some people have expectations that they're going to be transferring to Broadway, and someone's going to swoop them up and move them over to the Broadhurst Theater. And, you know, and I say that only partially with... partially joking. People really do feel that way, and no amount of conversation is going to change that feeling. That I've been working on a show, you know, I've been working as a writer for how many years? This is going to be my breakthrough.
Let's talk about the Dramatists Guild for a second. You know, anybody who really needs to know about this can look through all the news that has been over the couple of years. That's talked about the Dramatists Guild and Nymph. So why don't you just give us a minute on the history and what's currently happening?
Sure. You know, I certainly don't want to reopen a wound with the Dramatists Guild, but, you know, back in 2009, we moved to change our contract so that we would participate in the subsidiary rights. We asked the writers to guarantee us participation in the subsidiary rights of the shows, 2% of their income from the shows after they had made $20,000 for a period of 10 years. And we did this after having numerous shows that were very successful and had made a lot of money for people, at a moment in time when the economy had collapsed and funding was very challenging and we were very focused on trying to keep costs down for current and future participants. And in devising a model, I really tried to prevent... We went to the writers because we felt we could do that with the writers without encumbering the show and keeping additional producers from coming on board. We didn't want to encumber the piece by saying whoever came on as a producer would have to pay X, Y, and Z. But we looked to the model that actually the New York Fringe Festival was doing, and actually it was the identical structure. So we were very surprised when all of a sudden we were a target for a lot of criticism from the Dramatists Guild, because the Fringe Festival had been doing that for years, and so on and so forth. You know, I think realistically, as I mentioned to Michael, I think, you know, we are a different organization than the Fringe. We are very connected to industry and to some major writers, and are dependent realistically on the support of the leading artists and of this business to continue our role. And so the dramatists, we were a good target for the Dramatists Guild. And we were also going against the tide. They were in the process of getting a lot of New York's major theaters to roll back their participation in subsidiary rights.
Do any people come to the festival? I'm talking about authors, composers, lyricists, etc. Come to you people, and you say, "Hey, we've accepted you. We want you in our festival." And are there any people left who say, "Oh, that's great. How much are you paying?" Are there people who still believe that when they're accepted into a festival, that they don't have to put up a dime, that because you have accepted them, you're essentially saying, "Wow, what a wonderful piece of work. We can't wait to do it."
Yes, there are occasionally people who come to us. You know, we don't generally, it's not usually that we say we've accepted them. If somebody submits us their work online, which is how, you know, hundreds of people get our way, they have to walk through an FAQ that through all of this. And then between the process of being a finalist and getting invited, each of the Next Link shows has a dramaturgical and a sort of producing-oriented conversation with us, so that should they be accepted, we're all on the same page.
All right. Now, do you ever turn down a show because it stinks?
I'm sorry?
Do you ever turn down a show that's fully funded, the person's got a lot of money, it's going to be a bang-up production, there might even be a quasi-star attached, but it stinks. You read it, you've heard it, you can't believe how bad it is, and yet the person is raring to go, here's the check. Do you say, "Fine, right this way, your table's waiting," or do you say, "Look, it's not for us"?
Generally, we say, "Look, it's not for us."
Generally,
that's the case. But, you know, when we're talking about it stinks, I think there are different levels of readiness. There are shows that, you know, in programming Nymph, my goal is not to program 50 different events that are all my personal taste in theater and what I would choose to produce if I were an individual producer. I'm trying to program the broadest array of styles and themes that I possibly can, and to represent what I think is the breadth of talent out there. So sometimes there are shows that, you know, are not my style, but that I think have the bones of something promising or reflect a talented writer. That, you know, I never put something into the festival just because there's money attached that I think is horrible.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is a very challenging thing to produce, but we're also trying to, but we're trying to provide an opportunity that, you know, a lot of these shows aren't 100% ready when they come to us. And they're using the opportunity of getting a show on its feet to push it that final step. And, you know, a percentage of them will succeed beyond our wildest dreams, and some of them will fail.
Sure. All right. But over the 9 years, mm-hmm. how many times would you estimate, just a ballpark figure, you've said, "Look, we don't like your show. We don't think it's right. We're not going to put it in the festival"?
Oh, I say that many times every year.
So a ballpark figure would be what?
I mean, I probably don't put it in those terms because...
Of course.
But we say that, you know, to hundreds of people every year.
Okay.
Isaac, yeah, you had mentioned before that there is a committee that reviews the stuff before accepting it. Did I get that incorrect?
No, so you're correct. There are two streams of shows that come to us. Most of our shows come through this Next Link process, the open submissions window. And those get first screened by a committee of readers. There's about 30 readers that we have who are directors and dramaturgs and writers who help filter those down to a finalist group that goes to the Next Link grand jury, which varies from year to year, but they're industry leaders who help us review that finalist group and give us feedback on them. And then from that group, which is about 30, 10 get chosen for the NextLink project program. And then around those 10, we start programming other material that we think will supplement the festival in ways that, you know, that are amplify the diversity and the interesting, you know, dynamics of the festival's offering. So sometimes we go back to shows that weren't accepted through NextLink, and some of the other finalists get in a non-subsidized way. But a lot of them also are things that we recruit. Reanimator, for example, had a run in Los Angeles. It was in a different place. We brought it in. There have been dance shows that we've had in the festival. We recruit in other ways. We have international shows that are on different timelines. And now more and more, we're also working with shows over a longer period of time. We have a couple of shows that we didn't think were ready for this year, but we are talking about for next year and trying to work with them over a longer period of time. So those don't go through the blind submission process in the same way.
Isaac, I'm assuming here, and correct me if I'm incorrect, that this is, you know, the NIMP goes on for 2.5 weeks, but this is a 52-week-a-year job for many people.
Well, NIMP lasts for 21 days, and then I've got about 2 weeks of comparative downtime. Our submissions open in September for next year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we will be doing, it is for a core staff of five people, it is a 52-week-a-year job. And for a seasonal staff of another, 5 to 10 people, it's at least a 36-week job a year.
While you guys, I'm pretty sure you guys are not-for-profit. This is, you have to make some money to put bread on your table for your families and various things like that. So a lot of people have this misconception that the not-for-profit people are, working for free because of their love of the industry. And while you do work for perhaps reduced scale.
Yes, I will. There are administrative costs and salaries that have to be paid. You know, the organization's budget annually is about $1.5 million. And of that, about $1.1 million is direct costs of the festival itself, technical and support costs. There are other costs that relate to our producing a show in Korea, one of the shows that comes out of the festival every year we bring to Korea. And then there are several $100,000 in personnel costs. Everyone who works at the festival has to get paid. Everyone who works in the front of house at the festival gets paid. These are not volunteer positions, primarily because the expectation of professionalism is such that, we have a responsibility to train and to make sure that everyone is, if you're a show that's putting up as much as $60,000 to do a show, you don't want to be at the mercy of a volunteer who doesn't necessarily know their stuff.
That's great. Isaac, you and Chris Stewart started the festival?
Yes. Well, it was Chris's idea, and he brought myself and a group of founding producers on board. I was one of about 10. But I was the programming director, in fact, for the first year. And so I was responsible for finding those shows.
Previous to NIMF, what did you do?
I was the immediately prior to that, I was running a musical development program at Ensemble Studio Theater, and I was a director in residence there. And before that, I was the music associate for the Encore series. I was in charge of restoring all of the shows like House of Flowers and A Connecticut Yankee for 3 seasons at Encores. So I have a background as a musician and as a director. That's how I came to this.
Let me ask you two other questions forward-looking. What do you see happening to the festival in the next couple of years, and where would you like it to go?
Yeah, are you going to stay in the summer?
We are going to stay in the summer. it was overall, from our perspective, a great success. Attendance was up by about 10%, not counting all of the events in the hub. And obviously from a press perspective, I think we got a lot more attention. So the summer was really met all of our needs. We also, as you cited, were able to get venues that we really needed to get to improve the festival experience for everyone. Next year is our 10th season, and we have our board is currently at work trying to think about how we can leverage that. I don't want to spill the beans on some of the things we're thinking about.
Sure, yeah.
But I do think that, NIMF's role in the community has changed over the last 9 years, and we are now looking at how to manage it as an institution that can be here for another decade and that can serve artists in the fall, in the coming decade. So, of course, the concerns about how much artists have to raise are forefront in our minds, and we're looking at ways to increase subsidies and to find, to create a fund or things like that that can help underwrite those production costs. And I think that is something that over the next couple of years we will make great headway in. We started with a bang, way beyond our own capacity, doing 31 shows with a budget of about $300,000 in 2004, only possible because everyone gave us everything for free for the first year. In many ways, I feel like we're constantly, racing to catch up to our goals and our expectations for ourselves. But the 10th anniversary, seasons that are coming up are really an opportunity for us to catapult into another tier of operation, because we do hear the difficulties. And, and I think that if artists had longer to air their shows for the festival, then we would be seeing shows that are not just technically polished, but that have had another go-round in the festival, of development before they get to the public. And that's not necessarily a bad thing either. So, these are all challenges that we're trying to figure out how to execute, given that we have a staff of five.
And before we let you go, one last question. What's next for Isaac?
Well, what's next for me? I am about to take a small vacation. coming on board to help Without You, which was Anthony Rapp's show, one-man show that he did in 2010. I'm helping see that done at the Menier Chocolate Factory in London. So I'll be going to London later this month for that, which is very exciting. It's one of my favorite experiences of the past couple years at NIMF. And then we're back in September. After Labor Day, we're all back at work. We have our next Broadway Sensation competition, and we have submissions opening up. So,
A staff of five does all this, huh?
A staff of five does all of this.
That's, wow. Is everybody coming back?
Most people are coming back. We have Mike Cohen, who was our director of programming this year, is actually not coming back with us this year, although we hope he'll stay involved. There's always some turnover. It is a brutal, brutal schedule doing this festival. I don't know how I've lasted as long as I have. But as you can imagine, trying to produce this festival and be as responsive as we are to all of the artists involved is kind of backbreaking.
Isaac, is it possible for you to produce outside of NIMF, or is it just too all-encompassing that you could never possibly produce a Broadway show while producing NIMF at the same time?
I've been certainly asked to participate, and I haven't done it for a couple of reasons. One is that I feel every ounce of attention I can to trying to fundraise for NIMF, and it is really just an all-consuming job. at someday I do hope that I'll be able to do some outside things. You know, I'm just directing as well as producing. So,
Isaac, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and spending a half an hour with us talking about Nymph. It's truly had such an incredible impact, not only on the Broadway community, but the theatrical community worldwide. And maybe you and Anthony can join us on a Sunday morning to talk about your experience at Meunier.
I think that would be wonderful.
All righty. Well, you take care of yourself and have a great day.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
As Peter mentioned at the beginning, End of the Rainbow is closing. Other things that are closing that are very sad is that the Showbiz Shop Dress Circle is going to be closing on August 15th. Peter, have you spent time in Dress Circle in London? I have spent small fortunes in that shop.
You bet. One of the great tragedies of my life was getting to London during a period where they had a fire, and it was closed, and I missed its reopening by just a matter of days. I was in Dress Circle in January, where I bought the Matilda cast album and the London cast album of a show from way back when called Johnny the Priest, which, believe me, before the CD revolution was one of the toughest British cast albums to find. But anyway, a trip to London was never complete without going to Dress Circle. Michael Nelligan, a wonderful, just genial, almost, you can't say store manager, you have to say host, because he really treated everybody who came in there was a cause for celebration. It was like a party, and I'm really sorry that this isn't going to happen anymore. I have a feeling, though, that the shop might have done better if it were in a different location. I have to admit, I almost always had trouble finding it. It was tucked away in a very small street, away from a few theaters, near some, I'll grant you, but many times it took me a little reconnoitering before I could find where exactly it was. And I can't imagine that helped very much. I imagine there were some people who said, oh, the hell with it, when they went looking for it, that might have bought some stuff. But as we all know, the real reason, of course, these places are closing is because people are doing shopping online. That's no secret, and you don't need me to tell you that. But nevertheless, the conviviality of going in there and finding everything that the foreign cast album of Windy City. You know, I mean, really, it's hard enough to find Windy City, the London cast album, a score that I very much enjoy, though I think it's too contemporary to do for the front page, that famous play that was set in the 20s. It doesn't sound like 20s music very often. But nevertheless, to find a foreign cast album, I think it was in German, I may be wrong. But anyway, it was de rigueur at Dress Circle. They had them all. They wanted them all. They had them all. If it was doable, they would get it for you. But it was such a great place. It was a rare time for me to go in there and not see somebody I knew. And so every trip was old home week. And it's very sorry that that's not going to happen anymore. I'm as sad about that as I am about Tracy Bennett no longer performing in New York City. So if you can, if my trip to Calcutta was saying come to New York, stop in London, see Dress Circle, though I imagine it's going to be pretty painful because I'm sure even by now it's a shadow of its former self because they're obviously not restocking or reordering. But you know, I could have got the Matilda cast album for a little less money somewhere else, but I was much more intent on giving them my money. That was a very important value to me. I never, ever went to London without buying something at Dress Circle. So it's going to be sad not to have that in the off hours when I'm between shows.
Next week, as I mentioned, we're going to have Bruce Kimmel on, but we're also, when Michael gets back, we're going to talk about Into the Woods in the Park, but we're not going to really review it today. But I just wanted to mention a few things that I saw an article that the Public Theater is going to put a one act, just do act one for families in a matinee, which is, lots of people have talked about act one being a show within itself. What do you think about that?
Music Theater International, for whom I do a column, has Into the Woods Junior, which is basically the first act of the show. They do a lot of junior shows in which they condense so that, you know, kids who want to be in musicals would prefer to be in a so-called grown-up show rather than being a show with a title like Aunt Bessie Beats the Band or, The Three Little Pigs. Every little kid wants to be older, and as a result, he feels older if he's doing Guys and Dolls or Into the Woods. So, but usually, the junior shows are condensed. So a number cut here and number cut there. But Into the Woods is basically the first act. And so that's essentially what they're going to be doing in the park. They're going to be doing Into the Woods Junior. And speaking of the junior series, I went to see Shrek Junior the other day. MTI was just doing a presentation to see if it worked. And what they do is they give you a list of people, kids who are in the show, all kids now, who are in the show, and it's just alphabetically listed, and they don't tell you who plays what because they really want that ensemble feeling. But I would love to know the name of the girl who played Princess Fiona, because I am telling you, and she's extraordinary beyond belief. It is one of the few perfect performances I've ever seen in my life. This kid got every scintilla of every lyric and every word of the dialogue. She was doing everything absolutely correctly. And what's really nice is she didn't have this attitude of, I'm terrific. I mean, I've seen kids perform who are terrific, who know it and know it too well. And she didn't have any of that. I mean, she was just enjoying herself. And she was just a natural talent. And I've got to find out her name by hook or by crook, because I want to write it down and keep that name. Because, of course, luck and being in the right place at the right time, you know, is just as important as talent, if not more so. And the drive to succeed, you know, who knows, maybe, she has different goals. Maybe she likes doing this. It's a fun thing to do in the summer, but she really wants to be a botanist, you know, fine, you know, good luck to her. But she has the goods to be extraordinary. So it was fun to see Shrek Jr. and kids having such a good time with it. There was one girl who was in the chorus who reminded me of Effie White in Dreamgirls. You know that scene after Effie's been demoted in Dreamgirls?
Yeah.
And it's their next gig. And when it comes time for her to sing her line, she overdoes it. You know, in other words, I am a great talent and nobody knows it. Well, there was a kid in the chorus like that too who reacted just like that. But the point is, there were so many talented kids. There were like 42, I believe I counted, 42 kids who come to New York during the summer and do these workshops to try the new shows for the juniors.
Thing to do. I wish I did that when I was
young. Oh, me too. Oh, I would have sung like a bird if they had this when I was a kid. But it was amazing to see so many talented kids. All right. Nobody was as pinpoint perfect as this girl playing Fiona, but holy God, the talent was amazing. There was no weak link, not a one. I mean, it was just flabbergasting to see. So, Freddie Gershon, who runs the company, is always teasing me, because when I see kids do good work, I wound up with tears in my eyes, and it was no exception this time. When you see some kids as good as this, there's no other reaction to have but to cry in joy that they're doing so well. So anyway, for teachers out there who liked Shrek when they saw it on Broadway and thought, gee, I'd love to do that for my kids, I think a Shrek Jr. is coming your way reasonably soon.
So other things in the news we want to mention is that the Public Theater, as we mentioned, is going to be doing that one act, Into the Woods for Families, received a $4 million gift from the Bernard and Ann Spitzer Charitable Trust. So let's... hope that they parlay this $4 million into the next great thing next season. Also in the news is Gore Vidal passed away.
I mean, of course, we all got to go sometime, and Gore was no kid, but still, it was sad. I'm very glad that he had a show on Broadway while this was happening. You know, years ago, I read a Gore Vidal play that never got on called A Drawing Room Comedy. And I don't remember that much about it. I do remember, though, that at one point Jesus Christ was a character, and I still remember somebody going to a microphone and saying, "Will Jesus Christ please come to the mezzanine?" I remember that, you know. So, but the play never got on. Merrick had it for a while, David Merrick, but he dropped it, and then a young producer named Larry Feinberg tried to get it on, even signed Tom O'Horgan. who was very hot at the time, having done Hair. So this was in the late 60s, early 70s when this was happening. So I wonder if we'll ever see even a reading of that play, a drawing room comedy, which I remember enjoying, even though I don't remember very much of it. But we are going back, you know, quite a few decades now. So, maybe this will spur a revival of Visit to a Small Planet, which would be very welcome for me because there is a movie, A Visit to a Small Planet, but it became a Jerry Lewis vehicle, and need I say that it became very silly. So the sophistication of Gore Vidal's play was very much lost in the Jerry Lewis movie. Jerry Lewis played an alien. Now, in the original production, Cyril Richard played that part. Now, there's a profound difference between Cyril Richard and Jerry Lewis, and I don't need anybody to disagree with me on that. You know? But although I guess we haven't talked at all about Jerry Lewis possibly coming to Broadway as a director, right?
Sure. You know, I'm not sure. You know, it blurs what we mentioned of the podcast and what we didn't. But no, because we did mention that his the guy who was leading the charge in that production is a young unknown, and the cast is full of unknowns except for Jerry Lewis directing it, right?
I think so. You know, I'll tell you, there's a part of me that doesn't welcome a musical called The Nutty Professor. It's always so embarrassing to me when at the Tony Awards, they're giving out awards to movies, musicals of movies that the Oscars wouldn't have deigned to even look at. Yeah. Legally Blonde, I'm sure didn't get any Oscars. So The Wedding Singer didn't get any Oscars. But the idea of having, you know, somebody like Zoe Caldwell saying the nominees are The Nutty Professor. You know, I mean, it rubs me the wrong way. However, Marvin Hamlisch, whoa, there are very few, if any, Marvin Hamlisch theater songs that I don't adore. You know, and Rupert Holmes, smart guy, loves musicals, knows his way around. Believe me, I read the original Peter Stone first draft of Curtains. I've read it. It lives in my apartment. And I'm telling you, Rupert Holmes, whatever you think of Curtains, and a lot of people don't like Curtains, I'll grant you, but you wouldn't have liked Peter Stone's Curtain. And that pains me to say that because Peter Stone wrote the best book of all time in 1776, but he did not have a handle on Curtains, and Rupert Holmes really turned it into something at least that made sense on a basic level and was moderately entertaining. So so we really have to take our hats off to Rupert Holmes for that. Well, and so these are good guys.
Peter, it's quite possible that this in June 2013, not only going to hear the nominees are The Nutty Professor, but we could also hear the nominees are Honeymoon in Vegas and Diner, the musical.
Well, Honeymoon in Vegas ran into a little roadblock this week, but
it
doesn't mean it can't be solved. I mean, we all remember when Hair was off, and then a few days later it was on Clybourne Park, too. But Honeymoon in Vegas did run into a roadblock, I know, but I would like to see it happen because certainly Jason Robert Brown is a talented guy, and that would be nice. And Diner, sure.
Diner's also going back into workshop. They're rethinking it, making it a little bit smaller. But
I can't wait to hear the song in which the kid quizzes his girlfriend
about information
on the Baltimore Colts.
Yeah.
You may recall, or those who don't know Diner, that was a contingency on a guy's marrying a girl. She had to know and pass a test on Baltimore Colts trivia because he is this big fan of this football team, my heart bleeds for him. I thought of many times when I hear the Indianapolis Colts, because the team moved, how this kid must have felt when his beloved Colts moved. And so there are so many wonderful names from the era that would make some fascinating rhymes, like Gino Marchetti, you know, is one. I want to see what they rhyme with Gino Marchetti, if indeed they do that. Alan Amici, I guess we're going to hear something's peachy, but I mean, these were Baltimore Colts football players of the era that Diner takes place. So, and how do you rhyme Johnny Unitas? But that's easier now that I think of it. It's, you know, invite us, Unitas. Yeah. I mean, it's close enough. They'll use it, believe me. So, so I'm looking forward to that song, you know, and of course the irony, of course, of the girl Whether she wins, passes the test, or doesn't pass the test, the fact is that, of course, they wind up married anyway. Because when a lady has her mind set on getting married and has a guy that close to it, she'll make it happen. So,
Peter, do you remember that scene with the LPs, and she moved the LPs out of order?
Oh, yes.
And, yes. You know, would that be something that might happen in your house if your cast albums are moved out of the order that which you keep them in?
I have to admit, this, this truly, until the age of 30, when I said, you know, I've got to stop doing this, I've got to grow up. But, you know, most people file alphabetically. I do now, too. Okay. Some people file chronologically. I've seen that happen. Some people file by... composers, you know, they like doing it that way. Well, when I started doing it by performance number. And as a result, every week I used to sit down with Variety and move each of those shows that was still running, eight performances. I swear this is true. So anyway, during the time I was married, occasionally my wife would say, you know, gee, I feel like listening to Camelot. Where is it? I said, what are you looking at right now? Wish you were here. No, go to the right. Annie, get your gun. No, go to the left. You know, and the poor soul, I mean, you know, she liked show music, but it was very hard for her to find an album. So anyway, but I put a stop to that. And now it's, but I live alone. So as a result, nobody plays with what I have anyway. So by the way, yesterday I played Camelot, and for a good reason. It was 50 years to the day that I had seen Camelot. That's why on Thursdays I played. On Thursday I played No Strings, and on Wednesday I played A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, because it was 50 years to the day that I saw each of those shows. So I'm celebrating in that way. And on Wednesday I'll play The Unsinkable Molly Brown, because that'll be the 50th anniversary of that. But they're much easier to find now. You know, though I will admit I still remember Molly Brown ran 532 performances. And no, enough of this. Enough.
So, Peter, will you be playing Marry Me a Little?
I like Marry Me a Little. Who's doing it?
At the Keene Company is going to do it next month.
Yes, that's something. A company not known for musicals, but of course, Carl Forsman has left the company and it's a new artistic director. So as a result, we may see something a little different. I hope that they don't stop their mission, though. Marry Me a Little wouldn't quite fit into this. The original mission of the Keene Company, which I love dearly, was we like to put on plays that are good at heart. We believe that people are good at heart, and we want plays that really support the notion of that type of optimism. Well, that's my type of theater company, so I really, really would love to see that mission continued. But I'm not sure it is, based on Marry Me a Little. So, because one doesn't usually hear about too many Sondheim people being good at heart. But anyway.
Well, I love that these companies are picking up Sondheim's works, and we're getting a chance to see it. I don't think I've ever seen Marry Me a Little on stage, so it'll be an opportunity for me to see it.
Should, yes, of course.
You know, while I have seen Passion a few times, we have Passion coming up as well. So I'm looking forward to that as well. Before we wrap up, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time that we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you so you don't miss anything. You can also listen to us through Stitcher app, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you want to get in touch with Peter, Michael, or myself, please go to BroadwayRadio.com, and all of our contact information is there. That way you could send us an email or leave us a voicemail or just touch base with what we're doing on the show and weigh in. Also, it'd be really a tremendous help to us if you could go to iTunes and leave us a five-star review, a good review, and some feedback. If you have a bad review, email me first and tell us why it's bad. Don't leave it on iTunes. And that really would help us a lot to understand our audiences, and take the Broadway Radio survey at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So the last thing we're going to mention is that today, August 5th, Sunday 2012, is we're closing three shows today. We're closing Memphis, Harvey, and Mike Tyson, The Undisputed Truth. So What do we have to say about? Did you get a chance to see the Mike Tyson show, Peter?
No.
It seems that they didn't do the typical invites of theater writers.
And I didn't bother to call and say, let me go.
No, absolutely.
Life's hard enough, you know. So yeah. Memphis. I'll tell you, I think Memphis really in the second act when it comes out with that kiss. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
Was really a gasp-inducing moment of theater. And the two times I saw it in Memphis, the audience really responded to it tremendously. I'm always sorry to see Harvey go because I really do think it's a terrific play. But Mr. Parsons' TV series calls. But God love him for doing it.
Yeah.
My buddy Kevin McInerney was saying he went to a regular performance. What I mean is not a critic's performance. And he really believes that the ovation that Jim Parsons got from that audience as entrance applause was either the most substantial he had ever heard in his life or among the most substantial he ever heard in his life. And that's pretty impressive. So obviously people appreciated seeing Jim Parsons in the flesh, and it's very nice that he did it, and he did a very nice job with it. So I'm sorry that Harvey isn't able to stay around a little longer. In a perfect world, as I see it, Harvey would be with us every moment. The play, not necessarily the Pooka, but
absolutely. All right, so we'll wrap up, and reminder once again that we are not going to be recording next Sunday, but next Monday night, so you'll see us on Tuesday morning with an interview with Bruce Kimmel at Critcherland. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and James Marino here in New York and Michael Portantier, who is out on a beach somewhere in Provincetown waving a flag, we will say thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
My boy Bill, I will see that he's named after me. I will. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try to boss him or toss him around.